Part 1 of 4, delivered June 1st, 2012, from the series Four Great Essays of C.G. Jung, a bcrecordings.net copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled The Symbolic Life, Jung's Epical Lecture on the Religious Aspects of the Psyche.
And with that, I think I'll address myself to this evening's talk, as we are nearing now the fourth year of the publication of Jung's Liber Novus, which is its Latin title, popularly known as the Red Book. It is apparent that it was in the course of writing and transcribing the pages of that visionary work that Jung became convinced that the future would bring certain very important psycho-spiritual developments. And of course, as we always need to remember with Jung, the future is not the kind of superstitious fortune-telling type of forecasting of the future, like in December of 2012, the world is going to come to an end or something of that sort, which, by the way, has now been rather authoritatively contradicted. You may have heard about it that under the auspices of the National Geographic people, a number of monuments were found in Guatemala, which are Mayan calendars. And what do you know? The calendar goes on for thousands of years from this year forward. So those of you who want to go on for a few more thousand years, that's the one that you are going to opt for. If you just as soon see everything come to an end the end of this year, then go with the other one. And you know, there are all kinds of possibilities. One can bet back and forth, one thing or the other. But with Jung, these sorts of statements always encompassed a long period of time, and they were not nailed down to a number of years, because he was primarily linking his psycho-spiritual forecast, so to say, to the zodiacal ages, which, as probably many of you know, that last, and the average was about 2,500 years each. And so his vision was to the effect that the new zodiacal age, and here is, of course, the echo of the 60s, which, of course, was when Jung died, of the age of Aquarius, would begin within the next couple of maybe 200-300 years, and that this would bring a very important spiritual reorientation on the part of probably a large majority of the human race. And this would include particularly a new God image or image of God, and that this God would be identical with, in large measure, with what in Jung's works is described the self with a capital S, as we shall later discuss maybe a little bit, to be greatly distinguished from the human ego and other lesser principles, and that this self would now take the place of the concept of God in earlier historical periods. In 1915, which was, of course, while C.G. Jung was writing the Liber Novus, in fact, I think this passage is included in a footnote of the Red Book, he wrote as follows: through uniting with the self, we reach God. I have experienced it. Just like that. It has happened thus in me, and it certainly happened in a way that I neither expected nor wished for. The experience of the God in this form was unexpected and unwanted. I wish I could say it was a deception, and only too willingly would I disown this experience. But I cannot deny it. It has seized me beyond all measure and steadily goes on working in me. No insight or objection is so strong that it could surpass the strength of this experience. So, while of course there were others, this was perhaps the most important experience during the writing of the Red Book and in terms of his vision of the future. Edward Edinger, whom we spoke about some weeks ago and whose work we reviewed some weeks ago, probably one of the most creative and insightful writers of the Jungian fold, and Dr. Edinger had no knowledge of the content of the Red Book then or even at the time of his death, because very, very few people did, you know, until 2009, you know. So Dr. Edinger, who had no knowledge of the content of the Red Book, deduced from Jung's then already available writings that the intimate relationship of self and God will be the keynote of the new aeon, as seen and proclaimed by Jung, commenting on Jung's vision, in this case of the Mithraic lion-headed deity called Aeon, that Jung allowed to appear in the front piece of his book Aeon, and which I am pretty sure, unless it's a replica, stands or stood a few years ago when we were there at the very entrance to the Vatican Museum. It's a statue that's, and it has a humanoid form with the head of a lion with the serpent wrapped around the body and with his paw or hand, depending on what you want to call it, held up, you know. And it sort of stands there like the sentinel to the museum. And it's a Mithraic deific figure, and Dr. Edinger commented on it as follows: Jung is the first representative of the new aeon. He is the harbinger of the new aeon, what I call and what I think will in the future be called the Jungian aeon. Just as Christ was the first person to enter the aeon of Pisces, so Jung is the first to inaugurate the aeon of Aquarius. Of course, Dr. Edinger was probably the most outspoken and fearless exegete of C.G. Jung, and particularly of Jung's deepest spiritual message. If you want to be in touch with that, aside from the Red Book and some of Jung's own writings, you can really do very well by reading Dr. Edinger. Now, jumping a little bit around in time, on the 5th of April 1939, so about a little over 20 years after the conclusion of the Red Book, C.G. Jung gave a seminar talk to an organization which I don't believe exists anymore. It was called the Guild of Pastoral Psychology, and it was based in London. It was largely a foundation of British church people, especially, of course, of the Church of England, who were interested in Jung. And although this talk was not included in his collected writings until 1976, with the publication of the 18th volume of his collected writings, it was deemed important enough to have the entire volume of over 800 pages named after this relatively short transcribed lecture. So if you pick up the volume 18 of Jung's collected writings, you will see the entire volume is called The Symbolic Life, although only one large portion of it is the actual essay. So that's volume 18, just for those who like to look up the material and see whether I have said the truth or not later on. Volume 18, pages 267 to 281, or if you go by paragraphs, as the real scholars do, paragraph 608 through 696. That's where you can find the complete text, okay? Now, Jung's thought will, of course, readily agree that this lecture is one of his most frank and at the same time unusual pronouncements on the spiritual life. So Jung himself thought quite highly of this material, and so do, I think, a lot of other people as well. The lecture was given in response to two questions, the first of which was whether Jung had any views on what was likely to be the next step in the development of religion. And the second, why did Jung hold that believing Catholics at that time, you know, we are talking about 1939, were not as subject to neuroses as a lot of other folk, and what could Protestant churches do to counteract the tendency of their members to neurotic conditions? So the second part of the second question kind of is an admission on the part of some ministers who said, yeah, indeed, we do have a heck of a lot of neurotics in our congregations. What they probably neglected to say, that we also have a lot of neurotics in our clergy. But in any event, that was one of the questions. So the questions asked were based on Jung's statements, various statements relating to this earlier. Now, while these questions seem to be of specialized interest, and while many points of the question have become dated by the last 40 years, you know, since then, or 50, Jung's stand is still of really crucial importance for us today. So the context of the questions and Jung's answers needs to be maybe looked at also. What appears immediately is that Jung's critique of the religious situation of his day, and we might say that would apply probably even greater force, with even greater force to the religious situation now, and his suggestions for its improvement do not concern theoretical matters, such as dogmatic or moral theology and that sort of thing, but rather the practice of religion. Jung understood the religion in its strict meaning, you know, in the Latin religio, to join or to link back, whereby is meant the joining back of the human to and with the divine. It was evident to Jung that this joining is not accomplished by intellectual constructs, such as theological belief, but by practices that enlist much more of the human psyche than one function, namely the thinking function. If you want to hear a little bit more of the context, it was Jung's understanding, based in part on psychohistorical research, such as the one of Erich Neumann, who certainly was one of the most creative disciples of Jung, that certain historical periods, the collective psychological development of humankind took various steps. And so you might say that throughout the Middle Ages and thereabouts, the psychological growth of humanity in Western culture was very much along emotional lines and along the lines of a kind of not very specific contact with the unconscious. So the unconscious sort of ruled the psyches of people in the Middle Ages, largely through its emotional outlet. Now then comes the Renaissance, and after the Renaissance, very shortly, the Protestant Reformation, and then at that time another function begins to take over. Of course, once again, when we say take over, we are talking about processes that take a long period of time. But what takes over is the thinking function. And you can see that in various ways, because certainly the Renaissance in its own way is the beginning of science, as we know it. But experimental science. But of course it's still greatly interwoven with considerations that pertain to the symbolism of the unconscious, such as alchemy, for instance, which was not regarded as science. It was called the art, you know, Ars Magna, the great art, and so forth. So then it moves from there, and when it came to religion, there is no doubt about it that already beginning with people like Luther and Calvin, and to Jung certainly Zwingli, the reformer in Switzerland, and others, the thinking function took over to a very major extent religion. First of all, how do we express, if we are expressing it at all, the thinking function? By talking. That's what I'm trying to do, you know. First I think up what I'm going to talk about, and then I talk to you about it. So it is the expression of the thinking mind is the mouth. So what happens in the Protestant churches? The altar is pushed away, in extreme forms totally done away with, and the pulpit is placed in the center. And in the pulpit is the minister, who increasingly is called the preacher, because that's what he does. He preaches. So the expression of the thinking function by way of verbalization becomes the central focus of religion, beginning with the Protestant Reformation. So Jung saw that there would be this kind of development taking place. But every time some of these developments take place, they do some good, of course, but they also do some harm. And the harm is usually done by the way they displace earlier helpful practices and situations. And certainly that was the case, let's say, with religion also, that increasingly in Western culture, particularly where the Protestant forms of Christianity became normative, the sacraments and rituals, the symbolic psychic expressions of religion began to diminish, and eventually in many cases not just to diminish but to vanish. And this of course created certain difficulties. And in a major part of his lecture to the Guild of Pastoral Psychology, Jung dwells on this. And he says that the reason at that particular time that somehow the psychic life of many adherents of the Roman Catholic faith was healthier than that of the Protestants and the Jews was owing to the fact that the Catholic religion had retained certain practices and certain features which were extremely helpful to the psyches of people. I need to interject, even if I have to repeat myself, that this was said in 1939. And that today Jung would probably say very different things, largely because since then, beginning with the 1960s and the so-called Second Vatican Church Council, the Roman Catholic Church itself underwent something similar to, although certainly not identical with, the Protestant Reformation back in the 15 and 1600s, and came to impose interpretations on its own teachings and more particularly practices which were of a rationalistic nature, you know. Now, you know, I'm very familiar with church practice and church doctrine, and I could regale you with details for an extremely long period of time, and you would all get up and walk out. Some of you sooner and some of you later. So I'm not going to do that, obviously. But let's say, to make this very brief, but maybe at the same time pungent, the magic began to go out of the church. And the magic came to be replaced by features which are of a rational nature, because magic is non-rational. I will not say irrational, but non-rational. Magic, as people like Jung understand it, is dealing with the unconscious by way of symbols. Because the unconscious speaks in symbols. Already Sigmund Freud, who was pretty much of a rationalist himself, bless his cigar-smoking soul. But was it really his soul that was smoking the cigar? Well, I doubt it. But anyway, you know, it's air. But, you know, bless his soul, even Sigmund Freud recognized that, because he said that dreams speak in symbols. Dreams don't speak in a rational language, and that is why interpreting the dream is extremely important. And the dream, of course, is a direct expression of the unconscious. Sometimes a rather trivial expression, to our great regret, when we don't have a meaningful dream, but at other times a much more meaningful expression. Also, there are dreams which a certain friend of mine calls that come to us primarily for the purpose of entertainment. The unconscious wants to entertain us. It says, why should these people be entertained by the television screen and by the computer? I can entertain them better. And when the unconscious decides to do something, it usually does it very well. But let's say, when this interacting with the mystery within us, and perhaps, and Jung certainly would be the last one to deny that, not just within us, but through us, when that mystery with which we interact by way of our psyche and by way of our unconscious is activated, then a symbolic interaction takes place between the conscious ego and the unconscious. So they are communicating by symbols. And this is very much the case with all magic, whether the magic masquerades as religion or whether religion masquerades as magic. Anybody who thinks, whether he is a man of the cloth, which I always consider such a great expression, you know, that means that some of us have to wear cloth, clothing, even in a hot climate, you know, it's got to be cloth, not something, I don't know, silk or linen or whatever. Anyway, that whether somebody is a man of the cloth or not, but when somebody thinks that religion can be rational, he thinks and demands the impossible. It is a total contradiction in terms. And why is that? Because when we do this process of religio, of relinking, what do we relink with? Well, the religious person would say, of course, with God. That's all right. But how do we do that? We do that through the intermediate agency, psychologically speaking, of the unconscious. We can't do it otherwise, because it is a process of the soul. When somebody prays, what's he pray with? Does he pray with the rational mind? If he did that, the prayer would be defeated at its very outset, because the sort of atheistic portion of the rational mind would come forward and say, oh, you are engaging in an exercise in futility. Who do you think you are talking to? Who do you think is going to talk back? Who do you think hears you? Nobody. That's the voice of reason. That's reason for you. So, you know, that has to be suspended. That has to be put aside. And that's one of the things that, let's say, religion has, or prayer has in common with all forms of magic. Even the sleight of hand magic, the léger de main magic that you see performed in our wonderful little institution here in Hollywood, the Magic Castle, which, if you can, you really should go to. It's a terrific place. But, you know, what does all this magic have in common? And it has it in common with religion. What it has in common with all of these is that you have to suspend your rational belief. You have to distrust your senses and distrust the reasoning that attaches itself to the senses. Because what you see is contrary to all of these. It's different. Of course, there it is done with the skill of the hand, and the hand is faster than the eye and so forth. But at an other and a deeper level, the same thing is true of all magical activity, religious or otherwise. You are dealing with a different medium at this point. And therefore, when the rational considerations take over, the magic gets pushed back, and eventually the individual spiritual life is greatly impoverished. Why? Because we can't really live without magic. We become spiritually poor people. We join the ranks of poverty when the magic goes out of our lives. And that is why from time to time various movements of the spirit arise of one kind or the other, literary, poetic, artistic, religious, quasi-religious, that try to bring magic back into our lives. As Buffy St. Marie sang in the 60s, God is alive, magic is alive. You see? The two of them together, they are hooked up together. When God is not alive, when God is dead, as some theologians in Stanford came up with this great discovery that God is dead, you know, Althusser and Hamilton, I don't know if you remember that, you know. It was really a stupid book, but but you then, when God is dead, then magic is dead. And conversely, when magic is pushed out of the picture, life becomes banal. Jung talks about that in his study. Life becomes drab. Life becomes uninteresting and without mystery, and consequently without joy. So, yet it seems that humanity likes to do that from time to time. It likes to exercise the magic from its life, and then it goes around wailing and complaining. Oh, nothing is interesting. Oh, nothing is fun anymore. I'm not having any fun. I don't see any beauty. I'm not enjoying myself. Well, of course, because mental things and even sensate things bring only a limited amount of enjoyment. Now, Jung based a great deal of his critique in this talk on what he felt was an empirical fact that he gathered from his patients, that at least at that particular time, the Catholic Church produced seemingly fewer neurotics, and consequently there were much fewer Catholic, Roman Catholic patients of Jung than there were Protestant patients or Jewish patients. He wrote in his talk, of course there are Catholic neurotics just as well as others, but is a fact that in my 40 years of experience, at that time it was 40 years already, I have had no more than 6 practicing Catholics among my patients. Now, of course, I suppose one could try to account for it by other ways. Maybe the Catholic patients were more parsimonious and didn't want to pay the psychiatrist, or heaven knows what else. But, of course, that's really not the fact. They had other outlets. So he continue. These are now his own words from his essay. I was once asked by students of divinity a very interesting question, whether in my view people in modern times, in case of psychological trouble, would go to the doctor rather than to the parson or the priest. Now I said I could not answer that question, but I would inquire. And so he inquires, and he gave a questionnaire to certain people who were not known to be acquainted with him, and so forth, and asked, you know, first of all, whether they were religious belief or not, and in things like whether when they were in trouble, would they go to a minister or would they go to a doctor? And there I found the confirmation of what I already knew, which is always a helpful exercise, namely that a large percentage, by far the majority of Catholics, said that in case of psychological trouble, they would go to the priest and not to the doctor. The vast majority of Protestants said they would naturally go to the doctor. I had a very large number of answers from members of families of parsons, and they nearly all said that they would not go to the parson, they would rather go to the doctor. No doubt, because their experiences with their parson family member had convinced them otherwise. See? I also had an answer from Jews, and not one single Jew said he would go to the rabbi. He did not think of it. And I had one Chinese gentleman who gave me a classical answer. He said, when I'm young, I go to the doctor. When I'm old, I go to the philosopher. So, in any event, you know, all of this sort of involves the religious issue. And then he says further on down, now I have spoken of my experience in the field, but recently certain statistical researches have been made in America, also recently in 1939, you know, about the very same question, but from another angle. It is a sort of appreciation of the amount of complexes or complex manifestations you find in people. You find the least or the smallest number of complex manifestations in practicing Catholics, far more in Protestants and the most in Jews. That is absolutely independent of my own researches. A colleague of mine in the United States made these researches, and that bears out what I have told you. Now, Jung naturally asked the question, what is there about certain kinds of spiritual systems, such as the Catholic Church at that time? And again, I say today it would be a different picture, because the Catholic Church has undergone developments which impoverished its own symbolic system. There are some attempts at the present time by Pope Benedict, for instance, who is a wise old owl, and others to clean up the act and bring back more symbolism and bring back more beautiful ritual and things like that. But there certainly has been a tremendous destruction of the same since about 1965. So Jung asked the question at that time, you know, what is it? And it was the fact that unlike the overwhelming majority of Protestants and Jews, Roman Catholics, at least at that time, were leading what can be called the symbolic life. And that this symbolic life enriched their psyche, allowed them to keep certain neuroses at bay, and not only enriched their psyche in a general way, but enriched their psyche in a spiritual way, in a godly way, in a transcendental way. Now, these are strange statements coming from Jung, because first of all, he was never a Catholic, not even as a child. In fact, I think owing to some of the local folklore about how bad Catholics were, the folklore among the Protestant Swiss population. He was deadly afraid of Jesuits when he was a little boy. And of course the Jesuits, these people went up to look at the waterfall nearby where Jung lived as a child at that time. It was a tourist spot. So the priest came in their cassock and he saw this long figure in a black clothing and, you know, like a Halloween costume. And, oh my God, a Jesuit, he's going to eat me, you know. And he was really terribly, terribly scared. And if I'm correct, and I have searched the biographies and I haven't really found a real confirmation of this, but Quispel said it in my hearing and others, that during his long life, and in spite of the fact that he lived really relatively nearby, Jung never entered the city of Rome. Now, you know, I don't know, I heard that from somebody who knew Jung, I think it's true. He went to Alexandria, where a fortune teller looked at his hand and said, I can't tell you anything, you're the kind of person to whom one cannot foretell the future. That's true. But, you know, but he apparently didn't go to, he went to Ravenna, which is not very far. He went there with Tony Wolfe and they looked at the mosaics and they had a kind of a vision there, but not to Rome. Well, he had a reasonably large number of Catholic friends and followers, but most of them eventually drifted away from him, like the redoubtable Father White, who was really a good friend of his. Because they recognized that he respected the church and its system, but not for what they considered the right reasons. See? Which I think would also be true of some of us. That's the way they would regard us. Jung looked upon the overall structure of the church as a construct of mass-mindedness, wherein real comfort could be found only by those who have not risen above a certain level of individual development. Jung held that the more intellectual Catholics became, the less they appreciated their beautiful sacraments. That's, of course, what happened in the 60s. As long as they didn't think about them, the sacraments and the rituals worked for them. But once they began to mouth the theological platitudes by which the church ignorantly explained its own mysteries, the whole magic became to shake and shimmer, and it was reduced to a minimal level of effectiveness. In fact, Jung knew more about the background of the rituals and the sacraments than perhaps even the better informed priest. And he told us sadly in the same essay that he tried to have a seminar on the meaning of the Mass. And of course he later on did write a great piece about it. And they invited the Roman Catholic bishop of that area, the bishop of Freiburg in Switzerland, to send a theologian to talk to the psychologist and the psychological students about this. But after a while Jung found that what this clergyman was telling them was sort of uninteresting to them, because he did not talk about the spiritual effects. He talked about theological reasoning as to why this is done in a theological sense. And the theological reasoning was insufficiently psychological. You understand. And so there was no real communication between the churchmen there and Jung and his psychologists, and finally they told the good father to go home and do something more enjoyable than what he was doing there. And Jung, of course, Jung knew a great deal about these things, including their origins. For instance, he says here, you know that very important parts of the Mass, for instance, the communion host, had already belonged to the cult of Mithras, so it was present there. In the cult of Mit, he uses Mithras, the Greek form. They used bread stamped with the cross or divided into four. They used the little bells, and they used baptismal water. That is quite certainly pre-Christian. We have even texts that bear this out. And Jung then says, this does not prove that the Christians stole rituals from other people, but it means that when, let's say, the magic, the religious magic is practiced by people, and they may be coming from one direction, from another direction, from one church, or from one mystery, from even one part of the globe to the other, when they reach a certain level of spiritual consciousness, they very likely come up with very similar practices. They don't have to steal from each other. They don't have to copy from each other. They have to copy from the same source that the other fellow copied. And that is how such strange underlying similarities can be found between various religious systems. So Jung found himself really in a peculiar situation. He knew on the one hand that religious rites and sacraments, such as those in Western culture of the Catholic Church, work. He knew that they prevent people from developing many malign complexes and neuroses, but at the same time he recognized the theoretical underpinnings which the Church gave to these sacred magical rites as inadequate, as reductionistic and meaningless. He also recognized, for instance, that the practice of confession and absolution was of very great psychological benefit. And he said so many times. So much so that even though he didn't go to Rome, as far as we know, you know what? He received a special blessing from Pope Pius XII, whom I have very great regard for, especially since he and Pope John Paul were the only two popes whom I ever saw face to face. But he was a walking, talking archetype, that man, truly. You know, there are some people like that. In any event, Pope Pius sent him a special blessing for having encouraged so many Catholics to take advantage of the confession. Because Jung affirmed the psychological usefulness of the confessional. Now, so what Jung was doing here in this lecture to an audience that probably, I would say, to maybe 70-80% was composed of Anglican clergymen. Very often, bishops of the Anglican Church attended, all kinds of, you know, the Dean of Westminster and all kinds of people like that, and then the rest of them probably of psychologists. He told these people that it is vital and tremendously important that people should lead what he called the symbolic life. That one cannot attain to an ongoing spiritual growth without a symbolic life, and that this is really of very, very great importance. And then very sort of kindly and in a somewhat subdued manner, he intimated to the people there that there is a certain mystery beyond all of this that's very important. It's not just that symbols help, and therefore you should deal with symbols. But symbols help to contact the divinity that resides in your own soul and heart. It's not just the language of the unconscious in a generic sense, but it's the language of the self, with a capital S, of the God within, that is symbolic. And that, therefore, when you lead the symbolic life, you are coming closer and closer to that tremendous indwelling transformative consciousness, which is the heart and soul, the raison d'être of your being. And he said, for instance, that there are psychological conditions developing, and that was way back then, you know, developing in Western culture, which are similar to and affinitized to medieval mysticism. He says, you find certain things in Meister Eckhart. You find many things in Gnosticism that is a sort of esoteric Christianity. This is what he said. You find the idea of the Adam Kadmon in every man. This is, of course, a Kabbalistic word, but it's also Gnostic, the heavenly Adam, who is the Christ within. Christ is the second Adam, which is also in exoteric religions the idea of the Atman in Hinduism, or the complete man, the original man, the all-around man of Plato, symbolized by a circle or a drawing with circular motifs. You find all these ideas in medieval mysticism. You find them all through the alchemistic literature, beginning from the first century after Christ. You find them in Gnosticism. You find many of them in the New Testament, of course, and in St. Paul. But it is an absolute and consistent development of the idea of Christ within. Not the historical Christ without, but the Christ within. And then he goes on from there. And of course, today we know with some considerable degree of assurance that this came from his experiences in the Red Book. That is where he discovered the Godhead within, and he subsequently was able to write in various books of his that the figure of Christ was one of the best and the clearest symbolic descriptions of the Godhead within. And Jung, in this talk, advised the assembled clergy and others who were there that people, both religious and non-religious, needed the symbolic life. There is no substitute for the symbolic life at the sensate and the rational level, because the symbolic life penetrates much deeper than anything external or rational, and there it can make contact with that inner God. And so he says, and I quote him again, you see, man is in need of a symbolic life, badly in need. We only live banal, ordinary, rational, or unreasonable things, which are naturally also within the scope of rationalism, otherwise you could not call them unreasonable. But we have no symbolic life. Where do we live symbolically? Nowhere, except where we participate in the ritual of life. But who among the many are really participating in the ritual of life? Very few. And when you look at the ritual life of the Protestant Church, it is almost nil. Even the Holy Communion has been rationalized. I say that from the Swiss point of view, in the Swiss Zwinglian Church, that was his father's church, after his father was a minister, you know, till the end of his days, the Holy Communion is not at all a communion. It is a meal of memory. Now, it is the same kind of, pardon the expression, pernicious balderdash that has entered the Roman Catholic Church after 1965 and has done tremendous damage to the spiritual life of millions of people, and has convinced some of us that we are so much better off outside that organization than we would be there. But now I better let Jung speak. So he says, have you got a corner somewhere in your room where you perform the rites? As you can see in India, even in the most simple houses, they have at least a curtained corner where the members of the household can lead the symbolic life, where they can make their new vows of meditation. We don't have it. We have no such corner. We have our own room, of course, but there is a telephone which can ring us up at any time, and we always must be ready. We have no time, no place. Oh, my word, what would dear Dr. Jung say when now we have taken the telephone out of the corner in our room? Everywhere we go, we go on the street, all kinds of places, everywhere. In the nursery room of the children, even in the bathroom. The cell phone, this incredible, miserable thing, is there all the time. Oh, I think Dr. Jung would be very unhappy. Where have we got these dogmatic or these mysterious images? He says, nowhere. We have art galleries, yes, where we kill the gods by thousands. We have robbed the churches of their mysterious images, of their magical images, and we put them into art galleries. That is worse than the killing of the 300 children in Bethlehem. It is a blasphemy. Now we have no symbolic life, and we are all badly in need of the symbolic life. Only the symbolic life can express the need of the soul, the daily need of the soul, mind you. Of course, he was in Switzerland, and in this case in England, and there were very few people of those faiths present, but I must stand up here for the Orthodox Church. By the Orthodox Church, I mean, you know, all the branches of the churches of the East, the Russians, the Syrians, the Melkites, the Serbs, the Romanians, the Bulgarians, every family in whose quarters I was of that faith has the icons, and in front of the icons burn the lights and the incense, you know. So there are certainly branches of Christendom where these things have not been forgotten. But certainly speaking to a bunch of Englishmen of the Church of England, even in 1939, he was describing a very real situation. He says, everything is banal, everything is nothing but, and that is the reason why people are neurotic. So the meaninglessness of life, you know, causes the neurosis and causes the great mental disturbances of our age. So he goes on to say that we cannot trust our ego selves and make them really the ruler of our lives. The ego is ruled, at least in our cultural milieu, by the thinking function. You know, the ego consists of the four functions, sensation, feeling, thinking, and intuition. And in our cultural period, I would say it is largely dominated by the thinking function. That is the normative function. And when we do that, we rob ourselves of a great deal of meaning, a great deal of psychic energy, and particularly we discard the symbolic life and look at it as being valueless. So he says we neglect the greater self, obviously, because that is the one with whom we carry on a discourse symbolically. And he says we curiously also have lost touch with another fellow. He says, a very bad little man inside of us, the shadow. He says, so we have excluded and pushed out of the picture the God within and also the shadow. And we live in this kind of twilight zone in the middle of these two. He says, we have to deal with the shadow, we have to assimilate the shadow and bring it into consciousness, and we certainly have to relate ourselves and to dialogue with the with the greater selves, with the greater self. So here then are two conclusions which are pivotal in the Red Book and which come straight out of there. Now we can see why he spoke of these things, because we have seen them stated with great power and great drama in the Red Book. The first being, as he, I'm quoting him now, the Christ within, not the historical Christ without, but the Christ within. And the second being the existence of the shadow. Once again, primarily within ourselves, but also in the world. Here are the two great problems that developed historically, says Jung here, and also in some of his other writings, in the Christian culture. The projection of Christ completely into a realm external to the human psyche, and the neglect of the existence of the shadow because of the concentration on as an aspiration to complete goodness, as an imitatio Christi of a completely good God image. Both of these problems were non-existent, so says Jung in this particular essay also, in early Gnostic Christianity, as Jung very well knew and frequently acknowledged. So these statements leave us to a certain extent hanging, as it were, because Jung does not draw two specific conclusions for us. He merely states the case, and then he leaves it at that. Now, I shall venture now, in conclusion, to draw some conclusions. One should draw conclusions in conclusion. Here, recognizing that they are mine, and not necessarily those of anyone else, although I certainly am trying to base them on my understanding of Jung. Here they are. First, we have to recognize that a symbolic life is vitally important, and that the task of transformation or even just a meaningful living cannot be accomplished by the thinking function alone. The 19th century notion that the head and the mouth are the most important part of a human being is simply not true. We cannot think and talk our way to God, or to meaning, or to new transformation any more than we can eat or starve our way to the same goal. Of course, that's kind of the Hilletic approach, and we have that, of course, among us, you know. There are those who obsess with various diets and say that, in addition to all other incredibly huge benefits, they will also make you more spiritual. You eat this and you're going to be very spiritual. Or you don't eat this and you're going to be very spiritual. Or, on the other hand, if you don't eat, or don't eat most things, then you're starving your way to God. That's all. You expect a physical thing to produce a spiritual result. It's not going to do it. So, it seems, according to this seminal lecture, or essay and essay, that cultivating the symbolic life is the best preparation for the process and event about which we quoted Jung, through uniting with the self we reach God. Why this is so in detail I cannot tell you, but I think that empirically one can definitely prove this to exist. The symbolic life, the magical life, you know, when magic is alive, God is alive, as that particular song that I quoted puts it. The magical life prepares the way for uniting with the self whereby we reach God. It is too much to expect that we would jump from a primarily ego-involved life that is dominated by the thinking principle and occasionally invaded by the emotional nature or the feeling principle, and that from that kind of life we are going to jump into the divine. There has to be a development, and that development is afforded by the symbolic life. Now, I don't mean to say that the symbolic life always, in every case, and all the time has to be purely religious. And as I intend still to mention, there are problems with the religious life in Western culture, which to some degree were present already when Jung gave this lecture, but which have become much more powerful and much more troubling at the present time. And these make it, I think, perhaps difficult for a lot of people to practice the symbolic life within a consciously accepted religious context. But one way or the other, the symbolic life needs to be practiced. And so I would advise that if there is a, and even if there isn't, a resistance on the part of the individual psyche against obviously religious symbols of one kind or the other, if that seems to be a problem, if that seems to be distasteful, then one should concentrate as much as possible on art, on literature, on mythology, and if possible on mythologically or spiritually enriched and influenced music. I'm thinking of Wagner, for instance, and things of that sort. Because the symbolic life is present in these media. Maybe not as directly and maybe not as effectively as it is within a strictly religious context, but it is present. Well, in one of the crucial seminal chapters of the Red Book, Jung makes the prophetic statement that there are three phases of history, spiritual history, of the world and of the culture that are coming. And they are war, magic, and religion. And so, war, there certainly was. It was sort of beginning right about the time when the World War II and World War I had already happened, so the war with weapons, the physical war, was certainly there. But it, of course, also stands for conflict. But let us hope that except for things like Iraq and Afghanistan and this, that, and the other thing, that the age of war as a state of consciousness is probably past. At least let's hope so. But in that case, we are within the age of magic. And what does that mean? It means the symbolic life. That by hook or by crook, we have to avail ourselves of the transforming and inspiring influence of symbol. Of symbol and magic and sacrament. I prefer it being, of course, within the professedly religious sphere, because that has been my tradition all my life, but other people perhaps may reach out for it in other ways as well. But in some fashion, it has to be present, and that involves the curbing of that unruly animal, that unruly horse that we have within us, which we haven't been instructed to curb much, our thinking. Isn't that interesting? You know, you still find in all kinds of disciplines, whatever they are, you know, you got to control your emotions, you know, you got to control your passions, you know, all of these things. Whether it is your passion for blue crab and lobster, or whether it is your passion for sex, or whatever, you know, these things you have to keep in mind. But the insanity is the incredible counterproductive vaporings of your thinking function of your mind. Nobody tells you to control those. And yet where does most of the evil, most of the horrible things in your life and mine and everybody else's come from? Uncontrolled thinking. Now, you know, I could get started on that and then talk myself hoarse also right away. But let's just say that I think that is very, very evident, because our Achilles heel in this particular historical period over the last few hundred years, maybe even more, has been thinking. So I think thinking has to be curbed, has to be controlled. And room has to be made once again for the symbolic life. But we also need to keep in mind, and that is maybe more indicated today than it was in 1939, that this living of the symbolic life is not something that we do for its own sakes. We do it for the sake of that mysterious divine spark that dwells in us, and that Jung, when speaking to these Christian clergymen, links with the Christ in us, the hope of glory, not the Christ outside, not the historical Christ, but this indwelling Godhead. And it is really in order to get in touch with this that we lead the symbolic life. And so it is my feeling is that the third phase that Jung mentioned in the Red Book, after war and magic, that of religion, something that truly deserves the name religion, the relinking with the divine, is relinking our external personality meaningfully, humbly, and intelligently with the greater self. Through unity with the self, we reach God. But of course, there are difficulties along that line. The readiness, I think, of a good many people in our culture in this direction is growing. I hope that I'm an accurate analyst of the culture. Institutional religion, however, is in decline. Even in the most religious country in Western culture, the United States. But people are warming up to the idea of the God within at the same time. But there are problems, as you know, with everything in this world. As the seven sermons to the dead in the Red Book say at a certain point, to every blessing of God the Son, S-U-N, the devil adds his curse. So we always may expect some shadow element to appear, accompanying every good development. It's just that way, folks. I'm sorry, I didn't make it that way, you know. And so the concept of the God within, which is beginning to catch on in our culture, is already egregiously misunderstood. It's barely born, and it's already being twisted around in unhappy ways. The question is, what self is the self, with a capital F? Is it the ego with its myopia, its narcissism, its false self-importance? That would be very unfortunate. Can we say truthfully that we are gods? No, I don't think so. The fight about the God within has already begun, folks. It's shaping up. I just heard of a new book. It is called Bad Religion. And its subtitle is How We Became a Nation of Heretics. Well, I could contribute something to it, how I became a heretic, and I still am. Unfortunately, I couldn't get the name of the author. I heard his voice on the radio, but he's a writer for, among other things, for the New York Times. New York Times isn't exactly known as a fundamentalist rag, you know. So it's interesting that somebody there should come up with this. And that's this whole thing, that not the whole thing, but a significant portion of his critique is against the inner God. So, one of the answers to the predicament that Jung actually mentioned in this essay is to recognize the shadow. As long as we know that the shadow is there too, we are not going to suffer from that kind of monumental ego inflation. Oh yeah, you know, I am God, I can do it. Oh yeah, you're God, but you know what, buddy, you're also the devil. How about that? Huh? You know? Oh no, no, I wouldn't want that. Of course not. Yeah. But you know, they are both there. So that can kind of take you down a few notches so that you will not be so inflated. That can definitely help. But the most important thing is that we have to learn to look deeper and deeper. Past persona, past ego, past personality, past emotions and desires, past concepts and precepts, until we pass over a bridge. You know, it's a very ancient talk of symbolic life, a very ancient symbol, the bridge. Goes clear, you find it in all kinds of places. And certainly in Middle Eastern and Western religious symbolism, it goes back to Zoroastrianism, where there is a bridge over which one passes toward the divine. So we have to pass that bridge, which perhaps in the Hermetic Gnostic context was called by the Greek name nous, and come to the spirit, the real spiritual, the pneumatic self, the real God within us. The question is, can we do it? I think not only can we do it, but we must do it. Because if we will not do it, then we are not fulfilling the purpose for which we have been sent into this world in the first place, and we are not fulfilling the purpose which is especially vital at this particular time. So, meanwhile, there are certain criteria. Anything that increases our self-esteem, you know, a terrible cult that has developed in the world. I don't mean that one has to be a breast-beating, miserable sinner. But at the same time, too much self-esteem and the way the cult of self-esteem has entered our education and things like that is a pretty poor thing, you know. When children have to receive awards when they lose a game, you know, get an award for losing? Really? You know, because we have to build their self-esteem. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there are all kinds of stupid things going on in every culture, and they sure are going on in ours. They sure are going on in ours. You better believe it, you know. So anything that increases our attention to and regard for our personality, that bloats the ego, you know, how about the ego obesity? You know, folks, how about doing something about that? Let's start a petition and send it to that wisest of all wise men, the mayor of New York City. You know, tell him, look, you won't allow them to sell a large bottle of Coke. How about doing something about the bloating of the ego? You know, the ego obesity. So, you know, watch out for the tendency for ego obesity. Weigh your ego on a psychic scale at frequent intervals and see if the weight is going up a little bit too high. Not wealth, not health, not instinctual satisfaction, none of these things. And it's a horrible sign of our times that at the very time when institutional religion seems to be in a state of crisis, those relatively recently developed forms of institutional religion which worship wealth, which try to use a misconstrued symbolic life for building up their money, they become mega churches. while the other maybe really more deserving religious institutions suffer. This is a total corruption of the spiritual process. The objective of religion and the objective of the symbolic life is not wealth, it's not the health of your body, but it is contact with the God within. Not popularity with people. All of these things are part of human life, but they are not part of the inner God. When health goes away, when your physical obesity increases, when your beauty goes away, when your money is lost on the stock market and in the bank, that mysterious inner presence is still there. It hasn't diminished. The stock market hasn't affected it one tiny bit. And neither have all the shibboleths of the age, politics, and this, that, and the other thing. That is the worthwhile thing. That is the treasure in heaven. That is the mysterious philosopher's stone which we have to reach and find and hold on to, and which then really, in a very real sense, not in a physical sense, not in a financial sense, in a very, very real ultimate sense, will truly take care of us. That is the one thing that is capable of taking care of us. Nothing else is, because everything else goes away. Everything else is temporal. That is not. Is it eternal? Yes. But more in the sense of timeless. Never was time, it was not. End and beginning are dreams. Birthless and deathless remaineth the spirit forever. Death has not touched it at all, dead though the house of it seems. The translation of the Bhagavad Gita by Sir Edwin Arnold. That is the one. It has been said it is more radiant than the sun, and more subtle than the ether, and purer than the driven snow. That self we are. That self is us. Well, thank you very much.
Copyright MMXII by BC Recordings. Recording code 912F01. For Dr. Heller's presentations on a wide variety of topics, please visit bcrecordings.net.